Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. My name is Tara Elliott of Fish and Richardson. I represent the appellant, Microsoft Corporation, the plaintiff in the underlying action. I'd like to also introduce my colleagues here today. I have Kathy Reese here to my left, Lauren Degnan, my colleague Jeremy Anderson, and Joseph Warden.
Welcome to the court.
With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve.
Chief Justice is absent. In case you appear on another date when he's presiding, he would like you to stand up when you're introduced to the court and acknowledged.
With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. This is an appeal of the Chancery Court's dismissal of, with prejudice, of two counts, direct claims that Microsoft filed in a complaint of October of 2011. Those two counts were a subset of a larger set of claims, eight total, six derivative in nature, and the six counts that were derivative were dismissed without prejudice for lack of standing, and such standing has now been cured. We're here today to discuss the appeal and argument with respect to the two direct counts that were dismissed with prejudice as time barred. The briefs primarily focused on two main arguments. I'd like to highlight, however, as a preliminary matter, that this the procedural context that brings us here
today. Before we get to that, I assume you have permission from the BVI to bring the derivative action. Is that an update?
Yes, Your Honor.
And does that mean that you have or are going to file those derivative claims in the Court of Chancery again?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, a complaint was filed in December of 2012 asserting derivative claims pursuant to the leave granted by the Caribbean Supreme Court of the British Virgin Islands.
And would that matter be consolidated with this matter if somehow?
Our request would be that if Your Honors agree that this case should be reversed and remanded, that on remand the two counts that would be restored, if that's the court's ruling, would be consolidated with the derivative claims that are on file now.
Because they all arise out of
the same set of facts. I'd like to focus, just as a preliminary matter, on the procedural context in which we find ourselves, and it's highlighted in the first sentence of the Chancery Court's opinion, and that is that this action is before the court on a motion to dismiss. And I emphasize that procedural context because ultimately these two counts were dismissed as time barred, but in doing so, the trial court disregarded well-pled facts that under Delaware's conceivability standard, we submit, should have permitted the complaint to withstand a motion to dismiss. The complaint outlines Henry Fung, the director, one of the founders and directors of Vadim BVI, his sworn testimony in the summer of 2011, admitting self-dealing, fraud, theft of corporate opportunity, corporate waste, and breaches of fiduciary duties. And in other words, the complaint alleges facts that we submit justify Microsoft's ability to vet these claims through the discovery and an opportunity to be heard on the merits. And we think that's further underscored by the fact that, as Your Honors know from the record, this case is actually related to a patent infringement case that's currently pending in the District Court of Delaware. And in that case, discovery has been ongoing. And the discovery that has been that has come from that particular action directly affects and illuminates the very issues that are on appeal today. Now, obviously, I'm cognizant of this court's rules, and I don't plan to refer to any evidence that's not in this appellate record. But the point that I'd like to underscore is the impropriety of dismissing these counts at the pleading stage when they're intertwined with the merits of this case and where there's discovery that would further illuminate the issues of equitable tolling and fraudulent concealment. This court, or at least Delaware precedent, has held previously that where the tolling of the statute of limitations turns on controverted facts, a pre-discovery dismissal would be inappropriate, and that proposition can be found in the Dean Witter case cited in the briefs. Subject to Your Honor's preferences to the contrary, I want to focus first on the tolling argument of the two arguments that have been briefed. And the focus of that argument is whether or not the statute of limitations should have been tolled for equitable tolling under the doctrines of equitable tolling or fraudulent concealment. And as a backdrop, to that argument, I will highlight the following facts. Microsoft has been and is currently a shareholder of Vadum BVI, and under its memorandum of association, Microsoft was entitled to a vote on any disposition of all or substantially all of the assets. In March of 2000, Vadum BVI distributed a notice of or an information statement seeking the vote of the shareholders for a merger. And that merger was part of an overall restructuring of the company, which at the time was suffering losses and was in need of a cash infusion. And the merger, or at least the information statement, sought a vote on the merger, but in that same information statement disclosed to the shareholders that it was already in the process of transferring assets to the four operating companies that were at one time business units of Vadum BVI. The transfer of those assets was not subject to a vote, and an information statement made it clear that they weren't seeking a vote on the asset transfer, but that those asset transfers were at the board's discretion and determination. Prior to that information statement, Vadum BVI had drafted an information statement that in fact did seek a vote, or would have sought a vote of the shareholders, and the final information statement that they ultimately issued reverse course and did not seek a vote of that asset transfers.
That was learned how?
That was learned through discovery in the patent action. And that actually ties back to my first point about this, the fraudulent concealment and the fact that a lot of the discovery turns on these issues of tolling, fraudulent concealment and equitable tolling, both being present in this case. These asset transfers out of Vadum BVI into ANFIS, a Delaware corporation, was a breach of the Memorandum of Association. It was done so without a shareholder vote, and the Memorandum of Association required a vote of its preferred shareholders, including Microsoft, to effectuate or to effect or validate that action.
But the absence of the vote was known back in 2000.
The information statement disclosed that those asset transfers were taking place and no vote was sought. So Microsoft was aware that it did not get a vote. Microsoft wasn't aware, could not have known, and did not find out that the asset transfer was part of an overall scheme that Henry Fung engineered to get these assets out of Vadum into ANFIS for his benefit. These were facts that were first disclosed in deposition and sworn testimony in the summer of 2011, and we submit that Microsoft had no way of knowing that this underlying transfer, which Vadum told Microsoft and its shareholders in that information statement, was for the benefit of the shareholders, was to maximize the value of the current assets, would incentivize employees, would attract new capital. Everything in that information statement that Vadum BVI said to its shareholders said this is all a fair deal and in the best interest of Vadum BVI. And we submit that under the equitable tolling doctrine, Microsoft reasonably relied in complete propriety on the good faith and competence of its fiduciaries in accepting that statement. So although it knew that it was deprived of a vote, it had no way of knowing that that asset transfer was really a subject of self-dealing, fraud, and other abuses that are outlined in the complaint.
Doesn't the fact that you've been deprived of a very important right, which is to vote on this matter, and finding out that that's what happened, doesn't that put you on inquiry notice to look into the transaction itself, the one that you did not get to vote on, and that if you had done that, you would have learned about the valuation issue?
We submit that it would not for the following reasons. First, the information statement itself indicated to the shareholders, Microsoft included, that this was for the benefit of the shareholders. This was actually going to yield a net positive. And secondly, the standard for inquiry notice, and this is where we think the Chancery Court erred in its opinion below, or at least in one of the places, is that it did not follow the correct legal standard for inquiry notice. What we know from the winner acceptance case is that on a motion to dismiss, the trial court is to conduct a three-part analysis to determine if claims are time-barred. The first step being determining when the cause of action accrues based on the allegations. The second step, determining well, whether the plaintiff has pled facts that will lead to a reasonable inference that tolling is appropriate. And third, assuming that tolling is appropriately pled, when the plaintiff is on inquiry notice. The Pomerantz case defines what inquiry notice is, and this is where we think there's an error and why we don't think that just notice of that breach was enough to put us on inquiry notice. According to Pomerantz, plaintiffs are on inquiry notice when they have sufficient knowledge to raise their suspicion such to a point where persons of ordinary intelligence and prudence would commence an investigation that, if pursued, would lead to the discovery of an injury. And in Pomerantz, the succinct test is breach plus knowledge of possible injurious effect. And here we have notice of the breach, but not knowledge of the possible injurious effect. If Microsoft, because of their deprivation of its vote, had investigated, the first thing Microsoft, and probably it would have started and stopped with the KPMG report, which, you know, KPMG did an evaluation and evaluated the whole company in 1999. In that evaluation,
Ms. Elliott.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the, as I understand it, when that report came out, or the filing was done in 2000, it wasn't, it imparted notice not only of the fact that there had been a transfer of assets without a vote, but also that as a consequence there would be a dilution of the assets of the parent company, the now parent company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doesn't that additional fact create all the inquiry notice that's necessary?
We submit that it would not, Your Honor, because although the information statement stated that there would be a dilution in the shareholder value, that was a consequence of the assets, Vadum BVI going from having 100% ownership in the operating units that became operating companies to having 40%. And when the value of the assets of...
Okay, well, if that's not enough, then what would be required?
In this circumstance, Microsoft didn't know and could not have known that assets that are over $1 billion in value, according to the record now and the information we have in the record now, was transferred for $2. Had no way of knowing that until the discovery in the patent litigation case. And Microsoft reasonably relied.
Well, let's stop there for a moment.
Sure.
Those facts would constitute a waste or diversion of assets. But as I understand your tolling argument, it is that Microsoft was entitled to rely on its fiduciaries would behave properly.
Correct.
Meaning, I gather that they would, if they're going to transfer the assets, even without a vote, they'll do it for fair consideration.
Correct.
But the notice said that, that the assets were going to be diluted. And if fair consideration was given, for the value of the assets that were transferred, there would be no dilution. It would just be a transfer or a change of the form, but not a diminution in value. So again, I ask, why wouldn't the fact that there would be a dilution of shareholder value, which I think was an additional fact that was communicated, not be enough to trigger inquiry notice?
I think the information statement highlighted a few things. One, that the asset transfers had already started taking place, were ongoing in the process. With respect to those asset transfers, Vadum disclosed to its shareholders that it was a fair transaction, that it was in the interest of Vadum BVI and its shareholders, that it would maximize the current value of the current assets, and that it was overall for the benefit of the company. It would incentivize employees and attract new capital. That total message is one of not injury, but this is actually for the good of the company. This company is going under. It's in need of cash infusion.
Well,
and
let me interrupt you, because the exact language that's in the final information statement says, quote, the asset transfer will result in an immediate substantial dilution of the Vadim BVI shareholders as a result of the transfer of certain of Vadim BVI's operating assets," end quote. So there might have been all kinds of nice language that made it sound a little bit like this was a good transaction. But how do you ignore that statement and say, well, we weren't on inquiry notice?
Because that statement says, in effect, this short-term dilution in the assets or your value or your share of the assets will ultimately be for the benefit of your shares and the company as a whole. And had Mike, let's just take for sake of argument that did satisfy something that required Microsoft to go look into this. If Microsoft had gone to look into this and investigate and understand it, it says that would commence, raise suspicions enough to the point where reasonable persons of ordinary intelligence and prudence would commence an investigation that, if pursued, would lead to the discovery of an injury. Let's just say that notice right there, which would have or should have led Microsoft to look into it. Had Microsoft looked into it, they would have seen the KPMG report. The KPMG report, Big Three accounting firm, independently evaluating the company, said that these assets weren't worth anything. They were given no value. So Microsoft going from having 100% to say 40% when the asset value is nothing is not an injury. So they wouldn't even, upon an investigation in 2000, learned of an injury. It would have been, so we were deprived of a vote. What harm comes from that? And I'm reminded of Judge Posner's opinion and explanation of and question of whether it's rational for someone to file a lawsuit for the mere symbolic recognition of a harm, even of a wrong, even though no harm was done, because a right was infringed. It's akin to
judgment on the wall.
Yes, the dollar judgment on the wall, and we would submit it's against public policy. It would incent unnecessary and potentially frivolous lawsuits, and in this particular case, would reward fraud and self-dealing, and the use of Delaware corporations and Delaware courts as an instrument to effectuate that fraud and self-dealing. So we think under the Pomerantz rule, even under Pomerantz, just to akin this to Your Honor's questions, that in Pomerantz, they didn't stop at the April 2000 withdrawal from the partnership. Because if that was the rule, just as it's being tried to be applied here, then they would have never looked to the October harm that the court found that the plaintiff in that case should have discovered. So when you look at Pomerantz, even though the outcome came out differently than what we're seeking here, the rule was well articulated, just as it was in Dean Witter, which is you must know the breach and the possible injurious effect. Microsoft would not have known of the possible injurious effect of this breach, but for having taken Henry Fung's deposition in the summer of 2011 and hearing his brazen testimony bragging about his self-dealing. He admitted to a conflict of interest. He admitted to putting the second company's interest in front of the first, the second one being Amphis and the first being Vadim. And he had more than twice the number of shares of value in Amphis that he did in Vadim. These are facts that Microsoft would have never discovered in 2000, even after looking at that information statement and concluding that, oh, we didn't get a vote. Oh, looks like there might be a dilution of our assets. But this is all said to be in the best interest of the company. We have an investment here. We put $10 million. We have shares. And we're relying on our fiduciaries. And mind you, Microsoft had a business relationship with Vadim. They had previously invested in the company. They had previously dealt in another capacity with the company. It would otherwise turn a ordinary prudence and intelligence standard to one of paranoia and abject distrust. And we submit that that's not the law. That's not the standard here. And the standard in this case, as articulated in Pomerantz and in Dean Witter, is notice of the breach and possible injurious effect. We readily acknowledge we knew that we were deprived of our vote in 2000. We had no way of knowing and did not know that this was all part of a fraudulent scheme to move these assets from Vadim to Amphis for Henry Fung's benefit. So we submit, Your Honor, that the Chancery Court erred in its determination that, one, we did not plead facts of equitable tolling, and fraudulent concealment. I think the complaint details the basis for fraudulent concealment. And secondly, to the extent that the court stopped and that three-part analysis for Winter stopped at just the date of accrual without considering the inquiry notice really does require more than just the notice of a breach, the court erred in that respect as well. I want to turn very quickly to the other argument. Obviously, there's a threshold issue of whether the court should hear it in light of the fact that it wasn't fully vetted below. We submit that the answer to that question is...
It wasn't vetted at all, right?
The issue of whether or not statute of limitations defense can be raised in a void act, that particular argument was not vetted. But we would submit that it was intertwined with an argument that is below. And that's one of the standards this court has applied in the past as an exception under Rule 8, interest of justice exception, whether it's one of first impression, whether it's it would be judicially economically advantageous to answer the issue, and whether it was intertwined below. And we submit that those exceptions do apply, and that under Rule 8, interest of justice exception, that the court can hear it. We think the court should hear it. This issue has come before the court before, and did not get an answer before because it was mooted on remand. And so we think this is the type of issue that would come up again. And we think that in this particular circumstance, particularly in light of the language of the Memorandum of Association itself that says that voting was necessary to effectuate and validate this action, that this, in fact, was a void transfer. It was a legal nullity.
And void under BVI law? That's your position?
We think Delaware law controls, but they would also be void under BVI law as well. And I think that our briefs fully lay out the argument so that I see that my time is winding up. I'm happy to answer any further questions your honors have on this particular issue, but I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal, so if I may. I submit that the court should reverse on the grounds noted.
And you'll have about 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Carl Hill. I'm here on behalf of St. Clair Intellectual Property Consultants. Just some quick introductions. Mr. Girk from my office is here. Mr. Sullivan, who represents the other defendant appellees, is here as well. He's from the Sullivan and Hazeltine firm. And the two principals of St. Clair, Mr. Edward Chung and Mr. Thomas Baumgartner, are in the courtroom.
Welcome to the court.
Just as a thumbnail as to the way we've structured our side of the argument, and I know it's difficult at times, but there are essentially two arguments on appeal, the void issue, I'll call it, and the tolling issue, which is what most of Ms. Elliott's time is devoted to. So I am taking the first issue, which is the void issue, and Mr. Sullivan will be handling the equitable tolling issue. So I know questions will pop up, et cetera, but we're going to try to make the best use of our time, and we divided it that way after much discussion. There's a basic disconnect here as to what claims are on appeal and what those claims are versus what claims are a part of the counts that were dismissed based on a lack of standing. And there are three basic reasons here as to why the void issue should not be considered for the first time on this appeal. And number one is the relief requested, which is reading their briefs at page 6 and other pages, the voiding of the patent transfers from Vatom Limited, Vatom California, its subsidiary, to Ampus and then to St. Clair, is based on faulty premises and supposition of facts. And I'll get to that in a second. Number two, the relief requested, again, the voiding of these patent transfers, it may be a part of those derivative claims, and we reserve all our rights on those claims as well. But it's not a part of the two direct claims on appeal, and I'll get to that as well. And finally, the relief requested is barred, even if your honors wanted to consider this void issue, based on a statute that applies under BVI law. And I'll just add a a little more meat to that argument. Section 29 of the BVI Act, the Business Companies Act of 2004, by the way, is very similar to 8 Delaware Code 124, which says that no transaction can be invalidated by virtue of just the fact that the corporation did not have the power to exact that transfer of assets. And BVI law very consistently says the same thing.
Is that law retroactive in the British Virgin Islands?
We believe so, Your Honor, because below the argument was made by Microsoft that because the alleged acts occurred in 2000 and the act was 2004, there was no retroactivity. We hired an expert on British Virgin Islands law and established to Vice Chancellor Parsons' satisfaction that the 2004 Act applied and therefore leave was required regardless of when the acts occurred. And that issue, by the way, that BVI law applied and that the 2004 Act applied, which includes Section 29, was not appealed. And more to the point, the application and acceptance of BVI law was agreed to by Microsoft below on all of the counts. So those are the three bullet points, so to speak. But when the smoke clears here, and what you're going to see is Microsoft's maneuvering has to be seen for what it is. And the Court of Chancery's dismissal must be affirmed. I'll quickly go through those three points. The first one is supposition versus fact. The linchpin, and it's buried in all of this briefing, but it's on pages 9 of both briefs and page 6 at footnote 4 of the reply brief. The linchpin of their entire argument about the void issue is that somehow the defendants did not dispute that substantially all of the assets of Vadim Limited were sold without shareholder vote and that the patent transfers were thus ultra vires and void. Microsoft is confusing facts that are assumed for purposes of Rule 12 and facts that are finally adjudicated on their merits. And we never once conceded that point at all in any of the argument below, any of the briefing below, on the merits. So that linchpin is removed from the entire argument when you understand that that is not a fact that has been established and adjudicated. And I cited in our brief the Stroud versus Milliken case, which is, I think, maybe one of the seminal cases, although there are a lot of them, on the issue of advisory opinions. And what Stroud says is that an appellate court will not, for the first time, decide an issue that involves hypothetical or supposed facts. And that's exactly what Microsoft is trying to get you to do.
Well, how does that relate to this case? As your opponent pointed out, this is an appeal from a motion to dismiss, and we look at the well-pleaded facts and accept them as true for purposes of addressing the motion. I understand if you ever litigated this on the merits, it would be contested. But in the context of this motion to dismiss, connect everything you just said to where we are procedurally.
Okay. I will, Your Honor. Thank you. That sort of segues into my point number two. In the briefing and the argument below, and the complaint is a part of the record, we're looking at counts 7 and 8 only. Microsoft actually characterized the nature of those claims. And it's on page 16 of the opinion, and Vice Chancellor Parsons actually lifted a part of a brief that Microsoft filed. And I'm getting to your point, Your Honor, that the Microsoft characterized those two claims, the two direct claims that are on appeal, as relating only to the breach of the memorandum for failure of a vote to get failure of a vote on the sale of substantially all of the assets. And the language of Vice Chancellor Parsons is very correct, and when he's describing his acceptance of their characterization of the claims, and he does it two or three times, and on page 19 he calls it the gravamen of the claim relates simply to the breach of the memorandum. And that also dovetails with the precise language of counts 7 and 8, that they're direct claims for damages and that they relate solely to the breach of the memorandum. And Justice Holland, I think that answers your question in the sense that, and Vice Chancellor Parsons said, these were alleged facts, and we're assuming these alleged facts, but it's the alleged facts and the gravamen or the gist or the way that it was characterized by Microsoft as to what these claims are that's really on appeal. And what they're trying to do, getting back to my first point, is say, no, we want you to avoid these transactions. You know, if you look at the very last count, paragraph of the complaint, account 8, it says that in the alternative, we are seeking rescissory damages if rescission in count 3, one of the derivative claims, is unwarranted or decided against us. So what they're trying to do in this appeal and on this void issue, which wasn't raised below, is essentially bleed them all together and say, well, no, we clearly, you know, can get relief. But that's not what the counts are. That's not how they describe the counts. And the appeal only relates to those counts. And it really comes down to that there is no showing of interest of justice. I'm going to be anxious to hear Ms. Elliott tell the court what the interests of justice are. In this scenario, where they're trying to get to the finish line without ever hearing a starter's pistol or having any other people in the race, what they're essentially trying to do is get final relief, much to the prejudice of all of our rights. And that's precisely what this appeal needs to be looked at for. And Microsoft should not be rewarded. The interest of justice, in my opinion, based on the cases, is the integrity of the judicial process, of the legal process. And this would be turning that around. Really, it's a grave injustice to my client and to the defendant appellees to have this void issue decided for the first time today. Finally, the third point of my argument relates to the issue and my point about British Virgin Islands law. And I think I may have covered all that already, but to keep this in proper perspective, the cases that they cite about the extension of void judgments under Delaware law to the extension for corporate transactions, Section 124 would bar it under Delaware law. If the court's going to consider it, BVI law would control the internal affairs doctrine, and Segarra is the most recent opinion by your honors. Clearly says that voting rights between a shareholder and its corporation, are governed by the internal affairs of the place of incorporation of that company. That's British Virgin Islands law. In the characterization of the two counts that I referenced earlier, which is quoted by Vice Chancellor Parsons on page 16 of the opinion, the very last part of the quotation from Microsoft's position is that these two counts relate solely to a breach of voting rights. The Memorandum of Association on pages A41 and A45 of the appendix clearly state, and this is the Memorandum of Association or Charter, if you will, of Vatom Limited, the company in which they help the Microsoft hold shares, describes the rights as voting rights. And we believe that there's just no dispute whatsoever that if your honors choose to decide this void issue, which we suggest you should not, of course, the BVI law would apply, and even if somehow it were Delaware law, Section 124 would bar this argument. So having stated all of that, we believe that the interest of justice in Delaware and the jurisprudence of Delaware is not advanced at all by this court deciding the issue of voidness of the transactions or the rescission of those transactions. See this appeal for what it is, I suggest. In the patent action, Microsoft has claimed that the same patents are invalid and worthless. And here they argue contrary. They're constantly flipping their positions to try to get advantage. This appeal is yet another example of maneuvering by Microsoft to get a ruling here in Dover and to take it over to 844 King Street and to get some advantage. And when it's all said and done, Your Honor, the appeal should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Bill Sullivan representing Henry Fung, Vatom, the two Vatoms, and Amphis. Your Honors, as Mr. Hill described, I'm going to address the tolling argument. The lawsuit was brought in the Chancery Court in 2011, 11 years after Microsoft acknowledged receipt of a shareholder information statement that disclosed that assets were being transferred and that there was going to be an immediate substantial dilution of their interest in those assets. With respect to tolling arguments, there's no dispute that the determination of inquiry notice is central to the analysis. The Chancery Court determined that the shareholder information statement provided that inquiry notice. Microsoft would argue that there's a second element to inquiry notice, and that is inquiry notice first as to the wrongful conduct and second as to the extent of the injury.
That if I understand your side's position, it is number one that the second element isn't required to trigger inquiry notice, but even if it is, it was supplied here. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct, Your Honor. The complete harm was described to them. But in particular,
did I get that wrong?
Well, I never got to the point that we described the economic injury, because that's not an element of inquiry notice. We described the potential effect. So in that regard, I think Your Honor's correct. They can figure out what that number is, but nobody gave them a number, I guess is my point, Your Honor. And so I don't think and for that reason the Chancery Court didn't need to go into some of the analysis of fraudulent concealment, and that's because all of the cases that deal with tolling and deal with fraudulent concealment deal with fraudulent concealment before there's inquiry notice. In other words, trying to disguise the facts that would give rise to inquiry notice. And that's the critical element. Once there's inquiry,
concealing the facts that would lead to the conclusion that there's a claim or a possible claim.
That's correct.
And you're saying here those facts were not concealed. The communication that was sent out in 2000 told everybody that, or at least told Microsoft that there was an asset transfer taking place.
That's correct. And so once that conduct that they complain of was plainly disclosed, that's inquiry notice. It triggers a duty for them to investigate their claims to determine if they want to bring suit. And there is no further basis to assert fraudulent concealment beyond that, because inquiry notice means you must investigate, you must pursue, you must prosecute. There's no further reliance. I'm sorry, Your Honor. There's no further reliance on fiduciaries at that point.
Well, the argument that I believe was made in response to that was, well, even if we had at that point investigated whether or not there was wrongdoing, all we would have found was the report by the auditors, which assigned no value to those assets, and therefore there wouldn't. There would have been positive proof that there was no harm.
Your Honor, first of all, I think that's conjecture. Secondly, I think it speaks to a legal standard that they'd like to make, such as investigation futility. I'll call it that. I don't believe that's anywhere stated in the law. Whatever investigation they can do, they can do. And I don't think the opinion below went into what they could have done, because the opinion below didn't need to. But Microsoft acknowledges that they were not a stranger to this company. In the year prior to 2000, they had spent $20 million both investing and making deals with respect to licensing of patents. So Microsoft had done due diligence with respect to this company and could have done any investigation it wanted to. I do want to touch on the Pomerantz case because I think that case really helps assess the distinction here. Microsoft tends to conflate the two words injury and wrong as separate elements, and they're really not. In the case law, they're used interchangeably to denote the wrongful conduct that gives rise to a claim. In Pomerantz, the key point is that there was no actual notice of the withdrawal of two limited partners from a partnership. And what the Chancery Court tried to determine is at what point from the financial statements that the other limited partners were receiving should they have realized that there had been a withdrawal. In fact, in Pomerantz, in April of 2004, there was an agreement of withdrawal and an agreement to pay sums to two withdrawing limited partners that the plaintiff said was unreasonable. After that, the general partner solicited further contribution from other limited partners and painted a rosy picture of the partnership as still being successful. And the Chancery Court held that that was irrelevant because the fact is that the review of the economic reports was a duty of the investor and that the economic reports should have disclosed to a reasonably prudent investor that there had been a withdrawal and that they needed to act on their claims. And Chancery Court in Pomerantz specifically stated that one cannot wait until they recognize the full economic harm that comes to them before you begin the investigation and before inquiry notice hits. Your Honor, with respect to that issue, it may also be helpful to review some of the cases where they actually have gotten to tolling based on either fraudulent concealment or equitable tolling. And that goes to the cases such as Tyson Foods, where there was a backdating of options to key executives.
These are all in your brief?
Yes, they are. They're discussed in their brief and in our brief. So the key there is that where there was no misrepresentation as to the fact that they complained was wrongful conduct, there is no basis for continuing inquiry notice beyond March of 2000 all the way to 2011 when Microsoft takes the deposition in the case. And Your Honors, finally, with respect to the public policy argument, there's a statement made that fiduciaries should not be rewarded for trying to conceal harms like this. But the real public policy here with respect to inquiry notice is not permitting investors to sit on the rights to see if an investment goes bad and then decide whether they want to file an action. And the Alex Brown case, which was cited in the papers, went to that point and said even if there's no immediate harm because the fund is still doing well, you're obligated to act on the wrongful conduct, whether it's a breach of fiduciary duty or a breach of contract. You can't wait until the investment actually tanks and then claim that's when you got notice that you were harmed. So with respect to that, the inquiry notice occurred with respect to the issuance of the shareholder information statement, and we respectfully request that this court affirm the Chancery Court decision dismissing counts 7 and 8 of the complaint.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I only have a couple of minutes, so I want to touch upon briefly a few of the points made by both counsel. With respect to the implication that was made that Microsoft is somehow making up or creating this new speculative standard, the if pursued language that I spoke of earlier comes directly out of the Pomerantz case. So it's not speculative, it's not rulemaking by Microsoft, but that's actually the standard articulated by the court in Pomerantz as well as Dean Witter. And it makes sense when you think about the public policy of it. We don't want, and courts for centuries do not want to encourage frivolous, non-meritorious lawsuits. And to require a litigant to file suit for a breach that, from all reasonable standards, has no cognizable injury would be to incentivize those types of suits, and that's against public policy, but moreover, that's the standard that's articulated by the court. I want to go to also the point about fraudulent concealment and whether or not somehow Microsoft has missed the mark in terms of the equitable tolling argument. I want to point the court to the Winner case again that sets forth the standard three-prong test for what needs to be considered at the motion to dismiss stage to determine whether a count should be time barred. In that same case, it lays out the three ways that the statute of limitations can be told, and it actually defines each one of those: inherently unknowable injury, the equitable tolling, and fraudulent concealment. And with respect to fraudulent concealment, the court says, under the doctrine of fraudulent concealment, the statute of limitations will be told if there was an affirmative act of concealment or some misrepresentation that was intended to, quote, put a plaintiff off the trail of inquiry. And we submit that that's exactly what happened here. We were told in the same information statement, okay, you didn't get your vote, we're transferring these assets, but guess what? This is all for the best of the company. It's for the interest of the shareholders. It's going to maximize the value. It had every indicator that this was for our benefit. And Henry Funk himself told us he put us off the trail of inquiry, not just the shareholders. He put a big three accounting firm off the trail of the inquiry. He told them and purposely misrepresented the value of these patents to KPMG such that if there was any investigation, it would have yielded a result of no harm done, no harm, no foul. This is something he said when KPMG adopted his view of the value of the patents. He said in deposition this was, quote, music to his ears. This.
Kelly, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And thank you all for your arguments. And the court will take this matter under advisement and we will adjourn.